Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is returning VIP, Major Chris Karam. Hi, Chris.
Wow, how can I beat that introduction? Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to be back, and I'm glad you got promoted to general since the last time we spoke.
Yes, ever since the Iron Guts Kelly episode, I was that's just perfect. They're going to keep that till the final episode of MASHcast 15 years from now. So we're here to talk about season 4, episode 17, Der Tag, one of my favorite episodes from season 4, and that is saying something. But before we get to that, Chris, since you've been on the show before, I want to get you kind of your barometer here. And where are you on these seasons, the Potter, BJ, Frank seasons versus the three seasons that preceded it and then what was going to come later? Where are you on how you rank sort of those three, maybe four eras of MASH?
I think this is a very special era of the show, this year in the season 5, because it's obviously a period of transition. You know, we had Colonel Blake and Trapper the first 3 years, and the tone was lighter. I don't know if it was you or one of your guests, but you nailed it on the head and you said this season MASH goes from being a comedy drama to a drama comedy. And one of the great things is that by this time, by this episode, Potter and BJ have settled in so well that it feels like they've always been here. It doesn't feel like, you know, they're new anymore. They're really settling into their roles and they really have become a part of the cast, I guess, but I'm looking for another word. Anyway, I still am a big fan of the original 3 years, but this is a very special era where you've got Frank as part of it as well, and he'll be gone after the next season. But I also love, you know, Winchester. I thought he brought something really special to the show, and we'll obviously talk about that later. But, you know, one thing I was going to say is that I love how instead of, you know, just having another Colonel Blake type or a Trapper type, they went in for totally different characters this time out. You know, BJ being the, he's a partner in crime with Hawkeye for the carousing and stuff and actually the drinking. And then you have Potter who's an army man. But, you know, one of my favorite shows growing up, of course, was Happy Days, which I'm sure you've seen.
Oh, absolutely.
And that was a show that when Ron Howard left, you know, they replaced him with Ted McGinley playing a part that was essentially Richie Cunningham light. And Happy Days was never the same afterwards. Now, MASH isn't the same after Wayne Rogers and McLean Stevens left, but, you know, I don't find myself thinking that it's worse. It's just different. And it's in a lot of ways, it's more mature. So this is a season I really enjoy a lot. You know, I don't know if I'd agree with you that it's my favorite season of MASH overall or just TV in general, but it's certainly one of the best seasons of MASH in the whole pantheon of the 11 seasons.
Absolutely. And like I said, this is one of my favorite episodes of season 4. This episode, I think, is hysterically funny. So I'm really excited to talk about it. It originally aired on January 6th, 1976. So it's the first episode of the new year, written by Everett Greenbaum and Jim Fritzell, always reliable, and directed by Gene Reynolds. So it opens with Margaret in Tokyo for a medical conference. Frank is miserable, even more than usual. He's so miserable, in fact, that Colonel Potter asks Hawkeye and BJ to do him and the whole camp a favor. Be nice to Frank. Buddy up to him. Reluctantly, they agree, first by having him play in the regular poker game. Even though he doesn't know the rules, he wins a bunch of the hands, giggling maniacally after each time. They eventually take him to the O Club, where Frank gets loaded, flirts with Nurse Kelly, and then passes out. Hawkeye and BJ drag Frank home and in their drunkenness write up a toe tag and put it on Frank, declaring the body is, quote, emotionally exhausted and morally bankrupt. In the middle of the night, Frank gets up to go to the latrine, still drunk. He wanders by an open ambulance headed back to the front and falls into it. He's carted off without anyone noticing. The next morning, a medic at a battalion aid station calls Colonel Potter, telling him that they have one of his doctors there. Potter instructs Hawkeye and BJ to go get him. And while on the way there, Potter gets another call from the medic saying that the aid station is now under enemy attack. Hawkeye and BJ arrive as the bombs are falling and help out with the wounded. Don't even bother to wake up Frank, still passed out. Eventually, the shelling subsides and they cart Frank home. Just a few minutes later, Radar wakes up Frank, refreshed and ready to go. He also tries to stir Hawkeye and BJ, who are exhausted. Frank assumes everyone is still friends and is confused when Hawkeye and BJ, sick of the sheer effort it takes to be friends with Frank Burns, tell him they're back to hating his guts. Frank is happy, though, when Margaret returns. All right. So, Chris, this episode, I mean, man, I mean, we're going to go through it scene by scene, obviously, like we've been doing. But, man, God, I love this episode. I just think it is so, so funny.
It's a very darkly humorous episode, you know, and for just the reasons you said, even like the fact that like most of it takes place at night, you know, when they're hanging out at the Oak Club and everything. And what I love about Frank is that he's essentially a very joyless person. So when he has, you know, when he does experience some joy, you know, of course, after a couple of drinks or whatever, he has this like girlish giggle. Like it's almost like from one extreme to the other, from Mr. Like, you know, almost like a kind of Nazi in a way, you know, always kind of watching over the two guys and trying to nail them. You know, he's just giggling, he's dancing, he's having fun. And it's like Hawkeye said, he's, you know, he's a little rusty at having fun. And Frank is just, you know, what's funny is that Frank generally doesn't drink. But when he does drink, on the very few occasions when he has, he drinks like Hawkeye and BJ, you know.
Oh, yeah, he really pounds them back, yeah.
And, you know, to the point where Potter says, you know, you better watch it there, Frank. And he goes, oh, it's okay. I have a hollow head, which is a great line. And again, you know, one of the just very telling lines that Frank says about himself. But yeah, I think this is this show, this particular episode is a tour de force performance by Larry Linville. My God, he's good. I mean, we always knew he was great. I mean, but when he can go from that extreme to being, you know, this sort of joyless, you know, guy who is always looking, you know, nab people for something, to go from that to Mr. you know, giggly. And you know, I love the scene when they're in the Oak Club and he puts his arm around Hawkeye and BJ says, oh, you know, we're buddies at the front, and you can just see the looks of revulsion on their face. they're like you can almost like see their, I mean, skin crawling. Maybe if the high definition was a little bit better, you could actually see their, you know, their skin, their flesh crawling. But it's so good, and like he's just so good.
It's a neat idea that that someone that, you know, you have to deal with and that you don't like, you like to think, oh, it might be, you know, maybe it'll be easier for everybody if you get along with them. And then there are some people who are, as you put it, and quoting Trapper John, because he said Frank was this joyless, and he's so rusty at being a regular person that being his friend is exhausting. It's not just a matter of deciding to be nice to him. It's, oh, the price he makes you pay for being his friend. And in a weird way, it almost becomes easier just to go back to the old ways, because he's just so awful at sort of being, you know, being a friend in a weird way. And I, you know, I think a lot of us have known people like that in our lives, where I've never known anybody as bad as Frank Burns, at least in my real life. I've come close, but nobody quite that bad. But I have known people that for whatever reason, just being around them is exhausting, because they're like, they're nervous, or they're, you know, like they just have such a bad interpersonal skills that just being around them is really tiring. And, you know, of course, you're trapped here in this tiny little unit for, you know, who knows how long. And, you know, the only reason this would ever happen is because, you know, Colonel Potter really leans on them, and he uses those moist Colonel eyes, as Hawkeye says. Something else I like about this episode is, of course, in previous episodes this season, Margaret has not been around. That's because Loretta Swit was off doing a play, and so she wasn't involved in a lot of the episodes, and she was just written out, and there's no mention of her. She just does not appear. Now here, she's in the beginning part of the episode, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and then she's at the very end. But I like at least that there is some, you know, reminder of Margaret that, yeah, through the bulk of the episode, she's not around, but her presence is felt. And the whole reason this is happening is because Margaret is gone, as opposed to just sort of hoping the audience doesn't notice that one of the regular cast members is gone. So I like that a lot, that it's, you know, they were able to get Loretta Swit enough just to do these opening and closing scenes. And then the whole show, in a weird way, is about her, because Frank is just left completely at sea without her there. It's his only friend in the camp. Now, this episode opens in Radar's office with Frank on the phone talking to Margaret. And it opens, we all know, MASH was gleefully uncaring about continuity within its own you know, within its own universe, and then also in terms of references it would make. But man, there's some whoppers coming up here, because the episode opens with Radar asleep, and on his lap is a copy of The Avengers number 72.
I was going to mention that.
A comic book series, which of course did not exist during the Korean War. It's off by about 10 full years. And then on top of it, to make matters even worse, it's not even like Avengers number two. It's 5-6 years into the series at that point. And you have to figure that the 20th Century Fox prop department probably had a stack of comic books somewhere, probably purchased off a newsstand, maybe in the late 60s. And whoever the MASH prop person was, they weren't going to go to a newsstand to buy some comics, because then they would have been even more out of date. So they went to the, you know, 20th Century Fox prop office, and they just grabbed some comics, not realizing that anyone, a bunch of nerds, would be paying attention to this 50 years later.
Oh, yeah. It's great because, you know, I mean, maybe he gets his comic books from The Watcher. Or maybe, you know, like the Silver Surfer was flying around and he was asleep, just dropped the comics. Yeah, I that's not the first time they've done that. They've had, I believe they might have even had a Spider-Man comic in one of them. But yeah, you're right. They don't pay attention to that kind of thing. They kind of figure, who's going to notice this? But especially with the advent of high definition, you know, television and, you know, downloads and stuff. And of course, like you said, nerds like us are going to zero in on that.
Yeah. Oh, when I was a kid, I mean, look, I grew up, you know, I'm old enough that I, you know, I think you and I are relatively close in age. Yeah. That you know, we grew up in an era where you didn't see comic books in popular culture. You know, you really didn't. And so when they would show up anywhere in a movie or in a TV show, it was kind of a special thing, because you were like, oh, wow. Then you would try and make out what books they were. So the fact that a comic book would show up in MASH was kind of a big deal. But even then I knew, wait a minute, The Avengers, that's from the 60s. And on top of that, you know, we pan over to Frank talking to the switchboard operator as he's trying to get a hold of Margaret at her hotel. Then they cut back to Radar, and he's got a different issue of The Avengers on his lap.
Yeah.
So somehow the book has changed from issue 72 to issue 60. So I guess they shot those scenes in two separate days, and maybe they lost the comic or something. I have no idea. But it is really one of – in previous episodes, they've mentioned like Godzilla, and Godzilla wasn't out during the Korean War. It came after that. So that's one of the, but that's, you know, ish. It's close. But I mean, man, this is so far off. It's really sort of comical. And you got to figure the prop department was like, nobody's going to care. But man, as a nerd, as a comic book nerd who loved MASH, this was one of the rare moments where two things I loved, you know, it was like Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. You know, it was my two favorite things mixed together.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I probably didn't notice that when I was younger, but, and you know, it's funny. I just watched that episode earlier. I didn't notice that the comics were different. I'm gonna have to go back and rewatch that again.
The very first shot of Radar, it's issue number 60. And then in the longer shot, it's issue 72, the one where the Wasp gets married.
You even know which issue number is there. That's how, you know, and that's the type of thing, like you said, a comic book nerd would zero in on.
Yeah, well, I mean, I went and looked it up, and because I care about this nonsense.
Well, of course you do. It's your show. You know, you take pride in what you do.
Exactly. So now we get finally we get a shot of Margaret as she's talking to Frank. There's a nice little bit of you know, again, we've talked about that this show, TV in general, is a writer's medium, not a director's medium, because of the sets are always the same, the costumes are always the same. Most directors, at least in this era of television, don't really get a chance to go, you know, do much in the way of like filmmaking or like, you know, special shots or fancy shots. They really, you know, you have pretty standard stuff. But Gene Reynolds does a little bit of atmosphere here. When we cut over to Margaret, he starts the scene on a flashing sign, she's at the, presumably like at the Ginza or something. And it's got a little bit of an atmosphere because we see her talking, and then we pan over and we see her. Margaret laying on the bed, and she's like rubbing her foot, and she looks, it's a very alluring shot of Loretta Swit. I gotta say, it's like a kind of very sexy pose sort of thing. And but of course she's talking about to Frank about what she's seeing, and Dr. Nyler gave a talk on peristaltic rhythm and there's a thing about suppositories, the bullets of health.
I love that line.
Yeah, talking about the least sexy things imaginable. And of course, poor Frank, is concerned because he's, you know, he's worried about Margaret. And I also think he's worried about her because he knows Margaret, you know, Margaret's a catch, you know, I mean, he knows that Margaret is quite attractive. And of course he is not reassured when she mentions Fred, a physical therapist that she and the other nurses are meeting. Nice, but dumb. He hasn't got a brain in his whole body. And of course she says body.
and then Radar like mimics that because he hears Frank say.
Yeah. I love that Frank immediately picks up on it. Why do you say body like that? What do you know about his body? He's very, and of course he has to talk about how manly he is by one time killing a gopher with a stick.
Very defensively, you know, very like you say, he has to reaffirm his manhood by telling her that.
Yeah. So then she talks about that they went to the bathhouse and Fred likes to stay underwater, which again, I love that Margaret in this episode and in other episodes, like she really could be nicer to Frank because she's got to know how jealous he is. And I'm sure it makes her feel wanted, but it, you know, she really could sideline that stuff instead of talking about some handsome physical therapist, but she kind of likes tweaking Frank a little bit.
Well, you know, you jump ahead a little bit to the next season when she announces her engagement to Donald Penobscot. And it's one of these episodes where she's really kind of rubbing it in.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where Hawkeye kind of almost jumps to Frank's defense in a way. And, you know, obviously this is a discussion for the following season. But, yeah, you're right. She did kind of like to rub in the fact that, you know, oh, I met, you know, Fred and his body. And, or, you know, and she wasn't exactly very discreet about, you know, visiting generals visiting her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and Frank had to know, he probably told himself something else. But, I mean, how many times, especially in the first three seasons, how many times did, you know, it seemed like every general, with the exception of General Mitchell, was visiting Margaret, you know, on the side, especially yep. General Clayton. I mean, they have that hilarious episode where they thought they were going to have a ceasefire, and
yep.
And Hawkeye and Trapper take all these kind of revealing pictures of him coming out of her, you know. But anyway, yeah, I think you're right. You make a good point that she kind of does like to kind of get him going to sort of make him jealous.
Right, and to be fair to Margaret, Frank's married, so it's not like, you know, he's the one who's doing the cheating. But I just always find it funny that she could very easily scotch all this and make him feel better, and she doesn't. Frank mentions that when she gets back, he's going to play her his new Andre Castellanets record called Two Alone. And I never knew who that was. I had to look him up. It was a Russian orchestral music arranger. So I guess he kind of just did sort of classical music. Now, the weird thing was I was doing the notes for this episode a couple of days ago, and that's when I had to look up Andre Castellanets because I was not familiar with who that was. So I looked it up. And then later on in the day, my fiance and I went to a couple of antique stores, and we like to go through and looking for old records. And what do I find? A record by Andre Castellanets.
Was it Two Alone?
It was not Two Alone. That would have been that would have been eerie. But I mean, I just thought to myself, what are the odds that right. Andre Castellanets would come up twice in one day when previously he's never come up at all? I just found that to be pretty amazing. I was like, oh, that's Andre Castellanets. Okay,
that's funny.
I did not buy the record, by the way. So of course, Margaret hangs up on him. The call is ended, of course. And then there is a scene in surgery where we see that Frank is more than all thumbs. I mean, he is tense beyond tense. There's this before we get to that, though, there's a nice little run between Hawkeye and Colonel Potter where Hawkeye informs Colonel Potter that he's leaving. And the Potter's like, today? No, forever. He says, we're going to just pack me a doggy bag and I'm going to head off to northern Manchuria or whatever, go through Mongolia, take a ride at Siberia. And I really love that Potter just sort of goes along with it,
yeah.
Where he just says, so you're leaving. And he gives Hawkeye that rope to kind of go through this bit that Hawkeye insists on doing. I always find that very charming.
Yeah, it is. He's gotten to the point now where he knows when to indulge Hawkeye and just kind of let him blow off some steam or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's obviously gotten more comfortable with his command where, you know, he tolerates Klinger and he's, you know, become kind of like a father figure to Radar. But yeah, you're right. He knows when to just say, okay, let Hawkeye do his little monologue. Let him, you know, blow off some steam or whatever.
Yeah. What's the harm? You know, what's the harm? So then there's this moment where he drops, Frank drops an instrument. He blames it on Kelly. And then he says, well, you know, obviously he blames it on Kelly. And Kelly's like, well, she didn't drop it. And she says, you think I dropped it? And she's like, I didn't say that, sir. And he goes, well, it's obvious you thought that the minute I dropped it. And, you know, I mean, he's just absolutely like he's like a loose nerve, an exposed nerve in surgery. And then that leads us to a scene in Potter's office where Potter talks to his loyal subjects, Hawkeye and BJ. And he instructs him that, you know, look, Burns is driving everybody nuts. He says he insulted Klinger. He said his platform shoes made him look like a tramp. And it's just that, you know, Frank is just being extra. Frank is being extra Frank Burns. And it's just absolutely worse. And there's a line in here. Again, it's another line that I love because it's a reminder of where we are on the show, where Hawkeye says, Colonel, you've only been around him for a few months. He's been a boil on my butt for 100 years. And, you know, you just talked about how much Colonel Potter and BJ feel like they've been on the show the whole time because right. They fit so well into the rhythm of the show. But I always love those little comments that, yeah, we have, you know, we've had three whole seasons of Hawkeye having to put up with Frank Burns. And it's sort of like, hey, you know, Colonel Potter, you're sick of him. Imagine how bad I am dealing with him forever.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he's had to put up with Frank. I mean, from episode one, you know, and how many times, you know, did Frank take over as, you know, a temporary commander and impose all these crazy rules? I mean, he tried prohibition in one episode and we saw how that turned out. You know, Frank was just, he's like the worst person ever to take control of anything because he's just so power hungry, yet he has no idea how to wield it properly. But yeah, he's like you said, he's been a boil on Hawkeye's butt for three seasons. Yeah, exactly.
Of course, in real time, they're probably only about a year because the Korean War is, but you know, okay, whatever. So then we go to the swamp and everybody's playing poker and Burns comes in and he immediately goes, who said you could play poker in here? Which is hysterical, as if Hawkeye has ever cared about Frank's permission to play poker. This is like the 40 billionth game of poker they have played in the swamp. But I love that Frank just like he has that automatic kind of I have to be a dick about things. He has to bark at Hawkeye, even though he knows Hawkeye isn't concerned for one moment about whether he has permission or not.
Oh, yeah. And I love when he said, who gave you permission? Potter says, I did.
Mm-hmm.
Very authoritatively and like with more than a trace of irritation.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great, sir. You know, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing I just wanted to backtrack a little bit before we go forward. One of the things I loved about the scene in Potter's office is when Potter says, Hawkeye, BJ, I'm begging you. And Hawkeye says, who can resist those big colonel eyes? And the look of like this kind of smug smile that Potter has knowing that he got what he wanted from them. I just think that's a brilliant bit of acting on Harry Morgan's part, you know? Of course, Harry Morgan was brilliant. He really was Potter. But yeah, getting back to what you said about the poker. Yeah, you're right. When did Hawkeye ever give a rat's you-know-what about what Frank said or did? I mean, the only time it mattered to him is if he could hold it over him, like if he was the commanding officer and he put him on, you know, bed rest or something like that, you know, a house arrest, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, Frank just can't help kind of being a jerk. Like, he knows that being that way is not going to get him anywhere, but he can't help it. So then there's a little bit of conversation about getting Frank involved. And I love that Potter kind of nudges Hawkeye, you know, like, hey, get him involved. And they both, and I'm like, all right. So then I love that Hawkeye goes, Frank, and Frank goes, I don't have to take that. And the look that Hawkeye gives Potter is so great, where he's just like, oh, come on. Like, he's almost like, see, like, look, this is how bad this guy is. It's an establishing shot. It's a long shot of all the characters, so it's easy to miss because Hawkeye doesn't actually say anything. But I just, oh man, the look Alda gives Morgan is fantastic. Of just like, oh, see, we're okay.
Well, I saw that. I noticed that because I've watched the episode enough times where, you know, you notice the little subtleties. You look for that stuff, and yeah, it's brilliant acting. It's just like you can just see. It's like, oh, come on.
Yeah, yeah. Even when we're trying to even just talk to you, you can't help but be a jerk about it. Right. It's just ridiculous. But then, so they deal Frank in, and Frank talks about that. I don't know much about poker. Louise and I mostly played whist at the Moose Hall, to which Hawkeye replies, "I read that in Charlie Knickerbocker." Now, I never knew, long before I had MASH available to me on DVDs and in some digital form where I could watch subtitles if I wanted to, I never knew what the hell Hawkeye was talking about. I didn't know what, I couldn't even really make out what he was saying. It sounded like he said Charlie Knickerbocker. I didn't know what it was. And for years, and this is how kids, I think, put things together when they don't make sense, because you, as a kid, you want to kind of make those connections and you just sort of like pull things out of the air. I always assumed that it was some sort of like it was a purposeful malapropism on Hawkeye's part, that he was almost saying like, "Oh, that I read that in Nicholas Nickleby." Like it was a, like it was an old timey right. book, and it was a book I wasn't familiar with, or that it was something like Dickens and he was purposely saying the name wrong. That makes no sense. But as a kid,
yeah,
you have to kind of piece it together. But I looked it up, and Charlie Knicker, he's literally saying Charlie, Charlie Knickerbocker.
Oh, okay.
That was a pseudonym used by various writers in New York writing about society columns, right? Across different newspapers, different writers would use the pseudonym Charlie Knickerbocker. And it was in newspapers in the 30s and the 40s, mostly in New York, but apparently there were some in Chicago. There was even a female version. I forget the first name, but it was like Susie Knickerbocker. And it was basically, if some writer was writing a society column, they would use this pseudonym. And so then the joke makes sense, because of course, Frank is talking about playing whist at the Moose Hall, which is the most boring detail imaginable, not something that would show up in the society column. So the joke makes sense, you know, 40, 50 years later.
Well, that's the great thing about MASH, is that it forces you to kind of look up this stuff. You know, like there was a reference in some of the earlier episodes to someone named Adolf Monjou.
Yes.
Yep. And I'm like, who? You look it up. And it's like, because when I hear Adolf, you know who I think of when you hear Adolf.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But like, you know, this guy was definitely not Hitler. And it's interesting because, you know, if they're referencing stuff that was in the 50s or before, obviously, and they're doing it in the 70s. So it's kind of, I think it's good in a way when a show, obviously you're doing it because you're researching your show, but it's great when you have to kind of look up that stuff and kind of get, and like you said, you finally make the connection.
Yeah, I'm happy when I learn these things, because I always just assumed it was something else. And I'm like, oh, it's a real learning so much about the 1930s culture. Not that that is useful in any way nowadays, but that's how I know these things. So,
it's like listening to podcasts about MASH. I mean, you know. Is it useful? Perhaps, maybe to somebody, but, you know, we do it for the fun of it.
That's right. So it leads to this poker game, which of course means that Burns is going to get beginner's luck and win hand after hand, even though he barely knows how to play. He's already drunk. He talks about how the martini tastes lemony. I love Prodder's like, you got some lemons in there, Hawkeye? The way Alan Alda kind of does this shruggy delivery, threw in a couple of cough drops, you know, just kind of throws that in. But Burns wins a bunch of hands immediately. And it, of course, angers everybody because, you know, they want Frank to participate, but you don't want him to win. But that's always, I feel that's always like a writer's conceit in any TV show, is when you have like a gambling scene and somebody's like, oh, I don't know anything about this. They always end up with beginner's luck and winning a bunch of heads. It's like a comedy staple that you can't pass up.
Well, they would repeat it with Winchester a couple of years later when he was new to the unit.
That's right. I have never had a regular poker game with anybody. I would love to. It's always something MASH made it look fun to have that. I've just never been able to piece that together. I've never had the friends that were poker players. I mean, good Lord, I would be terrible at it, but I it was something I would always love to, because MASH just made it look fun, you know, just made it look really fun. I love the bit about where Father Mulcahy asks the Lord to bless his cards and Potter's like, same deal for me, Lord. And then you've got Radar doing the silent me too there, which is, well, I really enjoy that. And we see that the poker game obviously goes on all night, because we fade in back from the previous scene, and it's now pitch black at night. And BJ even has a line about Peg will kill me. So obviously, and then we see at the O Club, the pile of money Burns has. So he must have just cleaned everybody out.
Oh, yeah. And I like how they tell him, I guess it's customary for the winner to buy all the drinks.
Yeah, sure.
So they're taking advantage of his, you know, his windfall, of course, you know. I mean, they're not going to be totally nice to him. They have to, you know, they have to get something out of this. They're probably broke, too, which is probably why they're hustling him for drinks. And again, he's just drinking like, you know, he's a pro, like he does this all the time. I mean, Hawkeye and BJ, you know, they're a little more seasoned, so it's not as noticeable on them. But him, he's just giggling. And again, you know, the whole, oh, buddies at the front and, you know, for like one brief shining moment, Frank thinks, you know, they're all buddies, which is hilarious. And I love the fact that, you know, he sees Nurse Kelly and all of a sudden he's just rhapsodizing about her.
The curve of her gluteus maximus.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, Frank normally, he probably secretly did feel that way. But of course, sober, he could never, you know, consort with a lower ranking, you know, nurse such as her. And in fact, in one of the previous episodes, he made a disparaging ethnic remark that kind of offended her. You could tell
right.
She was hurt by it.
Right. Yep.
But then, of course, he cuts in on Radar, and she's got this deer in the headlights look as they're dancing, like, and she's just sort of acknowledging him and saying, oh, well, thank you very much, sir. Not like thinking, oh, my God, how do I get out of this? Which, of course, it doesn't last long. That's when he trails off, and he falls over, and he accidentally, you know, takes the slot machine, and, of course, he wins.
Yes, right. That's once again, yeah.
Yeah, and that's, of course, when everything comes to a head. He's out, and that's when, you know, Hawkeye is prompted to make the remark, oh, he's just rusty and having fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's just funny. Yeah. I was just going to say, it's just funny that, you know, he's got this secret thing for Nurse Kelly, and who can blame?
Well, right. That leads to something I wanted to mention, because there's an interesting detail here where he says he looks over, because we see that Radar is dancing with Nurse Kelly.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, I've had my eye on that in a long time. And, of course, that leads Hawkeye and BJ to look over, and BJ goes, Radar? And he goes, Nurse Kelly. And then Hawkeye says, Nurse Kelly? Really shocked. And of course, that is sort of a thread. I mean, I don't want to say it's a thread. It wasn't like they were purposely following up on it. But it leads nicely all the way to the season 11 opener, which is,
yes,
Hey, Look Me Over, where we talk about that nurse, the show talks about that Nurse Kelly is hurt and disgusted over the fact that Hawkeye doesn't look at her in any sort of, you know, romantic way, that he looks at all the nurses a certain way because, as she puts it, I'm not like a size 4 with a button nose kind of thing. And right here is that writ large, is him, the tone that Hawkeye puts in that, Nurse Kelly, almost like he's like, what? And you're like, what? Kelly Nakahara was adorable. Like, what are you talking about, Hawkeye?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
She was adorable. And, you know, the funny thing about it, like, I was thinking about her and Radar look so good together as a couple. And I'm thinking to myself, if MASH were being made today, I would be willing to bet dollars to donuts that Nurse Kelly and Radar would be an ongoing thing.
Hmm.
Because every character in sitcoms these days has to be paired off with someone. Radar the Naive Virgin would probably only last like a season now. I think he would be with Nurse Kelly at least for a while.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I always wish that, and I'm sure she did too, that unfortunately she passed away last year, that Kelly Nakahara had more to do on the show. I wish that she had, you know, there would be later episodes where they give more other nurses more to do. But I wish she had been given more, because I thought she was a charming performer. And she's sweet-haired. Like, she actually seems like she's enjoying herself with Frank. Now, maybe she's play-acting, or maybe she's just enjoying the fact that this is the one time that Frank's not being a total monster.
Well, you know, you mentioned how they didn't give her more to do. And like, in season 5, there's a really great episode called The Nurses.
Yep.
Which, of course, focuses on Margaret and a few of her nurses who are having some issues. Why wasn't Nurse Kelly part of
that
episode?
Yeah.
She's like the head nurse. Well, not the head nurse. She's like the one nurse that's in the most MASH episodes.
Yep. Yep.
Of the supporting, you know, the recurring characters, I would say.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the episode, "'Twas the Day After Christmas," where they do the Boxing Day thing where they all exchange roles. And like, Hawkeye trades places with the cook and stuff like that, Margaret changed places with Nurse Kelly. So yeah. they were clearly, you know, sort of suggesting Nurse Kelly is sort of the second in command of the nurses. So yeah, it never made any sense to me that she's not in that that nurses episode. But yeah, anyway, I wish she had more to do, but at least she gets this thing here. But yeah, every time I hear Hawkeye say Nurse Kelly, it's like,
yeah, I didn't pick up on that, but you're right. He does kind of like really? Yeah. I don't know about that.
He said it the same tone that as if you said Klinger. You know, you're like, what's up, Hawkeye? I mean, Nurse Kelly's adorable. It's very, very strange. So anyway, as we talked about, he passes out. He wins the money at the slot machine. I always have to wonder who fills this, like who empties that slot machine? What do they do with the money at the 477 of that thing? Because every so often, I guess you have to clean that out. So anyway, they drag Frank back to the swamp. They run into Colonel Potter, where he compliments them for being buddies to Frank. They bring him back to the swamp. He's passed out, and they decide, as a bit of a gag, they put a toe tag on him, which says, as I mentioned earlier, emotionally exhausted and morally bankrupt. And I got to tell you, that phrase lodged itself in my brain and stayed there. And I will tell you, many years later, I was in high school, and I was in a commercial art course with me and a couple of buddies, and we had a regular teacher, Mr. Jackson. And then one day Mr. Jackson was not in, so there was a sub. And the sub was, and the only reason I'm bringing this up is because it's relevant to the story, the sub was a 20-something blonde woman who was gorgeous. And that was, of course, a very unusual set of circumstances. You're not used to a substitute teacher being anywhere near, you know, kind of your age when you're a teenager, or at least that close, and being sort of very attractive. And so all the guys in the commercial art class, including myself, were acting like idiots to get her attention, because we were teenager boys and we were idiots. And at one point, one of the guys, I don't know why he thought this was charming, but decided to lay down on one of the tables. We had these long, we didn't have desks. We had these very long tables. And he decided to lay down on the table. And I posted a sign on him saying emotionally exhausted and morally bankrupt.
That's great.
Nobody got it because nobody else knew MASH like I did, but it meant something to me. So that was something that lodged itself in my brain. You know, shocking news, everybody. She was not that impressed. But nevertheless, you know, it was something I saw in a MASH episode and I remembered it all those years later.
That's great.
So anyway, we find Klinger on the sentry duty. He is very mad that he lost all of his money to Burns. Burns shows up drunk and he needs to go to the latrine. And he says, I need the password. And Frank just mutters like, bursting bimer. And in the subtitles, I learned he says bursting bladder, which makes perfect sense. I never realized that.
Close enough for jazz.
Mm-hmm. Close enough for jazz.
Yeah, it's great because he's just like, he's just totally out of it at that point. You know, he just wants to get to the bathroom. He's, you know, the fact that he's actually even on his feet is kind of amazing when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Considering how much he's been pounding him back and he's not used to that. So then Wounded arrives. Klinger does a bit of Al Jolson. It's amazing to me how thinly sliced the syndicators cut these episodes, because the version I saw on my local station, he breaks into the song and he does like the how I love you, and he starts singing Swanee. In the version, the full version of the show, he sings a second bar of the song, but in the syndicated version, I never saw that. They just cut that second line out. They just kept the first line. So yeah, that's how much these shows were trimmed down by the second, that they would reduce the second line of Klinger's song, which took all of probably three extra seconds.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Too bad. I mean, you know, is it really germane to the plot or does it advance things? No, it's just a little bit of business that they gave Jamie Farr to do, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the supporting players in those days, you know, sometimes they didn't have a lot to do in an episode. So, you know, all right, Jamie, you know, do a couple of lines from Jolson.
Yeah, exactly. So then Burns comes out of the latrine. He's barefoot, which is horrifying to think that he was in the latrine barefoot. That's just nasty. He collapses into the hospital, into the ambulance. The ambulance drivers don't notice, and they take off for the front. And we're like, okay, that's going to be a problem.
I love the way he does that little sideways thing, because he's got the toe tag on. So instead of just walking straight forward, he ends up doing this little sideways thing and ends up like just falling into the truck, you know, or the ambulance.
And you see him kicking his one foot like he's trying to get something off it. He's too drunk to look down and see what it is, but he's just kind of doing like a little physical bit of business, you know, where he's like, ugh, you know. So then the next morning, of course, Radar is trying to find Burns, and he can't. Hawkeye and BJ can't remember what happened to him. Potter is, of course, naturally a little concerned, and he is sure that Hawkeye and BJ are in on it, and Hawkeye and BJ are pleading innocent. And I love that he's saying he says, we're showing him a good time. He's disappeared. It's just, well, it's his way of saying thank you, which that's a great bit. And then while they're there, they get a phone call from a Nick Saunders, a medic named Nick Saunders, who seems to know Colonel Potter. Nick Saunders is played by the actor Joe Morton, who you've seen in a million things. He was in Terminator 2, Speed. He's in a great little movie called Between the Lines about an indie newspaper, which I saw for the first time just a couple of weeks ago, which is actually quite good. He was the lead in the movie, the cult movie, The Brother from Another Planet. And most recently, he was in Justice League playing Cyborg's dad.
That's right. Silas Stone himself.
That's right. We won't hold that against him. So Saunders tells him that we've got one of your men here. He's got a toe tag on him, which is emotionally exhausted and morally bankrupt, whatever that means. And he says that, if you want him, you got to come get him. And I love Colonel Potter's. They do not deliver. He instructs, I need two volunteers, Pierce and Honeycutt. And it's one of those things, again, I don't think it's a bright move to send. You've only got four doctors at the hospital. One of them is already gone, and you're going to waste the other two on this errand. You're going to send them to the front on an errand. I think that's something maybe Igor could handle.
Oh, yeah. You could send Klinger even, you know?
Yeah.
Radar and Klinger, yeah. But of course, this falls into what Larry Gelbart once said. You always want to put your characters in the situation they least want to be in.
There you go.
And, of course, you know, like as Potter finds out shortly after they leave, they're being overrun, the aid station. And as he said, they're going into a holocaust.
In the meantime, there is a little scene with Potter and Radar where Radar is taking some dictation and he's talking – Potter's talking about that he wants to – he's telling this general that he wants to sign up for his daughter is selling magazine subscriptions. And he says, put me down for 2 years or Collier's, I believe. And Radar is like, kind of like, what? Like, is this like a scam? And apparently this general pulls this all the time because he says, back at the army base, I had a 4-year subscription to his wife's cupcakes. And I love the way Harry Morgan kind of puts the cupcakes. Like he really does like the cuh in cupcakes. It's not a really funny line, but he really sells it quite well because he's just sort of telling this weird story about the like a general who's kind of putting the squeeze on everybody at the base.
Yeah, Harry Morgan is just one of those actors who, you know, can take a fairly ordinary line or, you know, line reading and just inject something into it that just takes it to a different level or gives it some kind of oomph that it wouldn't have had. You know, another actor might have just read that line straight, you know, verbatim. But again, you know, like we know with the actors on MASH, there's a certain – they know when to kind of accentuate certain things to get – I mean, you know, just like you said, Hawkeye kind of shrugging off in one of the earlier scenes, like he just sort of says the line kind of offhandedly, but it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, you know, Radar's trying to understand what's going on with this general. You know, you're right. His wife's cupcakes.
Yeah. It's just – there's a million ways to say that line. A lot of which you would just kind of smile. Like, oh, okay, that's a nice thing. But the way that Harry Morgan sort of spits it out is fantastic. While they're at the aid station, there's a nice little moment where, again, a reminder that BJ is inexperienced, where he says he asks a medic for a suture setup. And Saunders says, no, 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 we don't do that here. Basically, just get him stable and ship him off. And again, you know, a nice little detail, a nice reminder. This is something that BJ is not familiar with. He's treating the aid station like it's a MASH unit, and it's not a MASH unit. It is get the guy stable enough to get him to the hospital. And, you know, obviously pretty quickly, BJ would adjust. But I like that the writers thought to include that little moment, again, just as a reminder that, you know, this is still all new to this guy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Hawkeye, you know, there was a season three episode, I believe, where him and Margaret and Klinger went off to an, I think it was, in fact, called Aid Station.
It's the Aid Station, yeah.
So Hawkeye, you know, he's familiar with the routine, and he can just slot himself into it with no problem. But BJ, of course, you know, wants to, you know, do everything he can to help this guy. And no, 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 we don't do that. It's kind of similar to what Winchester went through in his early episodes, where he wants to do all these fancy touches. And no, no, we just sew him up and ship him off to Tokyo for the fancy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Again, I love that they took the time to do that, throw that extra 5 seconds in on the scene for that. So then they get back to the unit, and Hawkeye and BJ are, of course, nearly passed out at the swamp. And Frank is feeling refreshed because, of course, he's been asleep this whole time. They talk about they don't even bother to wake him up at the aid station because, like, as a doctor, he's hitting his peak right now.
Yeah.
As the debris is falling down on him and he's all snug as a bug in a rug kind of thing. Yeah, he's making that little.
He's having a very nice dream.
Yep. Yeah.
Whereas the horror of war is basically unfurling around him, he's totally oblivious. And I do like the fact that when he does wake up, he's completely refreshed.
Yeah.
Hawkeye and BJ are like, you know, because Colonel Potter wants to see them about something. But he just wakes up, he's like, okay, I'm ready to go. You know, what's with you guys? Come on. You know? I mean, Frank, you know, like I said, the guy who basically, you know, doesn't drink, but when he does, not only can he drink like a pro, but he can get up with no after effects.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He has no hangover. He just bang. He's refreshed and he's ready to go.
If I had half the drinks he'd had, I mean, I don't drink a lot myself. But if I had like half the drinks he had that night, I'd be an embalmer's, you know, dream the next day.
Oh yeah, the last time I don't drink very much either. But the last time I drank of any real significance was a couple of years ago when a bunch of us of the network went to a Comic-Con and I drank a little too much and ended up throwing up the next morning. I was feeling like a real. You know, real lightweight, but I couldn't help it. I was like, oh my God, I forgot.
Yeah.
I really can't really drink much anymore. So Margaret finally returns. Margaret gets back. They make small talk on the compound for the benefit of everybody. And she has the line about, you'd be amazed at the things you're doing with suppositories this year. And, he says, how was the weather? And she just says, lovely. And they enter her tent. And then there's this big scene, not a big scene, but there's a fairly extended scene of them in Margaret's tent, where they are sort of really excited to see one another. And this was all cut in syndication. I never saw this in syndication. It was always cut with lovely, and then it would go to a commercial and come back for the button scene. So this was kind of all new to me when I got the DVDs.
Yeah, I mean, it makes no sense because you'd want to see – that's like a payoff, you know, for all he's gone through and all he's put everyone through. And now he's finally reunited with his love and – it just makes no sense to cut it, especially when there's probably another bit of business that they probably could have cut that wouldn't have been as noticeable.
Right. Like they left in the scene with Potter and Radar talking about the cupcakes. Like they left that in, which that had nothing to do with anything. Yeah.
That could have been taken out wholesale and it wouldn't have affected the episode adversely.
Yep. Frank does mention all the boring goings on at the 477, including the Sonja Heine hygiene film that they watched of Ice and Lice. And this is, I think at some point, I need to keep track of this. When this show finally wraps up, I want to do a master list of all the fake movies that are in the 477 because their titles are just fantastic. I love the idea that Sonja Henie, who of course was an ice skater who they kind of drafted into movies because she was such a good ice skater. She's really not much of an actress.
Wasn't the one like the blob that ate Pittsburgh or something?
Yeah, the thing that ate the Bronx.
The thing that ate the Bronx. Mom Pa Kettle have a baby.
Mom Pa Kettle have a baby. Godzilla and the Bobby Soxer. All that stuff. As far as I know, Sonya Henie never did any hygiene films. You know, and like, but I love the idea that of Ice and Lice is that it's a hygiene film and also a skating film, because that's what Sonya Henie did.
One of my favorites is the VD film, Hansel and Gretel.
Hansel and Gretel. That is.
You really should. You should like, you know, maybe as a side episode or whatever, you know, just do an episode where you name. I mean, you could spend the whole episode just naming off the movies.
I shouldn't jump ahead because we're going to have that episode, but it's years away. My all time favorite one. My favorite one is when Hawkeye mentions the training film about about a field PAX, and it's called Your Canvas Buddy. I love that. Just sounds like the most boring thing possible. Trying to make something sound interesting. Field PAX, Your Canvas Buddy.
Oh my God.
I would have loved to have seen that movie. That's just fantastic.
No, I
probably wouldn't. So then that's the end of the episode of the two of them getting all canoodly with each other. And then we follow up later on, and they are in the mess tent. Margaret is talking about Fred again, and that he has a samurai sword. And of course, Frank picks up on that, and he's like, well, where did you see it? And of course, Margaret, realizing that she's maybe settled a little too much, says, oh, he has a picture of it in his wallet, which Frank completely buys.
Yeah, of course, because Frank, you know, probably doesn't want to go too far down that road with, you know, with Fred and his body.
And then we pan over and we see Hawkeye and BJ watching them, enjoying themselves. And I love how miserable BJ looks. He's so unhappy because he's tired. And he's sort of like, we sacrifice so those two could be happy. He has that real annoyed look on his face. It's great.
And this was really before BJ would start to show that characteristic more and more often. But you're right. He's already developed an intense aversion to Frank. I'm sure it's like Frank, it's like Trapper said, you know, like Frank said to Trapper one time, why do people take an instant dislike to me? It saves time.
Saves time, yeah.
And, you know, in the early episodes, BJ kind of toes the line. He's a little more respectful of Frank. But very quickly, he just becomes disgusted with Frank, and he has no respect for him as a doctor or as a human being. And, you know, that didn't take very – like, that's, this is, and this goes back to what I said about, you know, BJ and Potter kind of feeling like they've always been there.
Mm-hmm.
He's already got that thing for Frank. And Potter, you know, from, like, day one, you know, knew – he saw Frank coming a mile away.
Oh, yeah. He's seen guys like this before. And you see Hawkeye sniffing his food, a trait that he would do throughout the seasons. And you would even find out later that BJ finds it annoying that he does that. But you see him kind of sniff it and put it down. So it's a great, funny way to end the episode. And overall, it's a great show. It's just really funny from beginning to end. It's a nice kind of, inversion of an idea that, you think that maybe if everybody's nice to Frank, it'll just be easier, and you realize it isn't. It's not any easier. And in fact, it's even a little harder because Frank is just such a joyless person that even making him part of the gang is worse than having him as an enemy. And again, it's a really fun idea, and it's just a brilliant episode.
It is. And it's just one thing I wanted to mention, going back to when they were, and he was dancing with Nurse Kelly, he referred to her as a hotsy totsy. And I had only heard that term referenced on the show. You remember Welcome Back, Cotter.
Sure.
Now, there's a character on Welcome Back, Cotter called Hotsy Totsy. Her name was Rosalie Totsy, but they called it. I didn't realize that that was a general term to describe, you know, an attractive woman or a hot woman.
Yes.
So this is, and I'm like, Hotsy Totsy. I'm like, oh, okay. So this was not something that Welcome Back, Cotter created. This was just something that was in the vernacular.
Yeah.
You know, and now I realize, oh, okay. So it's just interesting how, you know, something like that, a kind of relatively innocuous term, but it obviously was in existence long before Welcome Back, Cotter. And MASH, I'm sure, wasn't watching Welcome Back, Cotter and getting their, you know, pointers on comedy.
Probably not.
No.
I love the way he says it too. He's you're a real hotsy totsy. He's just very excited.
Like I said, you know, he would never, you know, sober admit to be, you know, having a thing for someone who's kind of, who he probably considers beneath him. But mm-hmm. when, you know, Margaret's away, he, you know, all bets are off.
Yeah, I said it's a really, really, it's a terrific show. It's just really funny. It's one of their lesser, I mean, there's not a lot of serious stuff going on. We talked about that the show transitioned from sort of comedy drama to drama comedy. This one is more straight up a comedy, but man, when it's that good, it's great. You know, it's just really, really funny. So, do you have a particular favorite joke or line from this episode, Chris?
I would have to say I like when, like again, when he said, when Potter, you know, kind of says, "Hawkeye, BJ, I'm begging you, you know, buddy up to this guy." And Hawkeye's line, "Who can resist those big Colonel eyes?" It's just a great line. It's just so Hawkeye. It's very, you know, kind of dripping with sarcasm, but at the same time, it's also kind of drenched in affection for Colonel Potter, as we will find. You know, they've already come to really, you know, adore Colonel Potter, and they've embraced him. You know, he's not Henry Blake, obviously. They can't walk all over him. But that's great. And the other one is, you know, like you said, when they were in the aid station, he's reaching his peak as a doctor, Frank. You know?
Yeah.
I think those are probably the two best lines. And, of course, you know, Frank's, "I have a hollow head." You know, and of course, he plays a hilarious drunk.
He does. Everybody on the MASH cast was good at that. Nobody beat Loretta Swit. I think Loretta Swit just had that perfect kind of pickled, like that. She did it the best. But everybody on the show was good at playing drunk.
Well, I think it was the Alcoholics Unanimous episode. Is that the one where Frank declares the prohibition?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, when that scene with the three of them, her and Trapper and Hawkeye, and they're just really getting drunk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she said, and when Frank leaves the room, she says, "Who was that?"
Mm-hmm.
And they burst into hysterics. She is a very funny drunk.
Yeah, she's great.
She loosens up. That's when you see, I think that's when you see, like, the real Margaret. She actually can, like, be buddies with Hawkeye and Trapper, or even later on, obviously, Hawkeye and BJ, when they've had a couple of drinks, you know, after a, you know, long day or whatever.
Yeah, she loosens up. I mean, those are all great lines. My favorite one, actually, is when they drag Frank out of the O Club and they're dragging him back to the swamp, and they run across Colonel Potter, and he's in like a robe. So obviously he's walking from the latrine or from the showers back to his room, back to his tent. And he says, "Boy, you know, guys, I really got to thank you guys for doing this. This place is going to be a lot better now." Basically saying, you know, the place is going to be a lot easier to deal with thanks to you guys being buddies with him. And Hawkeye says, "Only if we bury him." And without missing a beat, Colonel Potter goes, "I buy that." And right at that moment, he makes a hard right out of the scene. And there's just something about the way Harry Morgan / Colonel Potter just completely, like, it's like the classic improv yes anding, where he takes Hawkeye's joke. "The only way things are going to be buried is if we buried Frank Burns. I'd buy that." And he just walks out of the scene. I laugh every time. Just the brilliant timing of the scene and the fact that he does his joke and then exit the frame. It's so great.
That's a great, you're right. That is, it's a great line. And and Harry Morgan, like his, just the way he delivers the line and then just saunters, you know, off.
Yeah.
What else is there to say?
And they've concluded this conversation. There's nothing left to say. So, yeah, I mean, Dirt Tog, it is just a absolutely fantastic episode. So, Chris, thank you so much for coming back on to MASHcast to talk about it with me.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And I'm glad I had a lot of fun, you know, last season, and I hope we get to do this again next season.
Absolutely. So why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I also have started a podcast with my friend Mark Karnzorowski. It's called The Double K Super Show. And we talk about music from the 70s and the 80s. We talk about a different subject each time. And you can find The Double K Super Show on Podomatic or Apple Podcasts. You can just search it. And we just dropped our 17th episode. So it's going well. And, I hope people will, you know, listen and enjoy it and let us know what they think about it.
Very nice. What inspired you to do a show about that?
I've been wanting to do one for a while, a music show. And finally last year, a friend of mine said, well, are you going to do this show or not? Because my, you know, my partner in crime was kind of like, yeah, I'll do it if you want, you know, and he's been really great about it, but I kind of had to take the ball and say, okay, we got to do this. And mm-hmm. once you do it, it's not as hard as I thought it would be. I mean, it's not consuming. Yeah, I was probably convincing myself that it was hard. I mean, the hardest part really is just editing it. It takes time, but it's a lot of fun. It's very rewarding. The great thing about this show is once we're done, it's your problem, not mine.
I don't do that many guest appearances, but when I do one, it is kind of a remember, wow, this is easy. I just show up and say stuff and I get to hang up and that's the end of that.
Yeah, you must have a pretty heavy load because you're doing several shows for the Fire and Water Network.
I have a heavy schedule. We'll put it that way.
Well, you know, it's funny because sometimes, you know, occasionally there'll be a week without a MASH cast or a Superman movie minute. And I'll be like, hey, where's the show? And I almost get angry, but then I'm thinking, wait a minute. This guy is doing it for free. He's doing it, you know, he's doing like four or five other shows concurrently. Ease up. You can go a week without hearing him and you and Chris Franklin talk about, you know, Gus Gorman or whatever.
I appreciate your self-reflection there, because there are some people who aren't always as polite about it. Sometimes take a week off, people? Like, come on.
Well, none of us are doing it for the glory or the money.
No.
We do it for love, because it's time-consuming. You know, not the talk. The talking isn't the hard part. It's just putting the show together, getting it out there, you know, hosting it.
It's just I have so many things that I like talking about.
Oh,
and
sure.
I get the idea, and then I start doing it, and then I realize, oh my God, I've got like seven shows going all at the same time. This is crazy. But it's just, you know, once you get that bug in it, I've told people that have asked me like about starting a show, I'm like, be careful, because once you get started, it's going to get under your skin, and it does. You know,
I've already got an idea for another show that I want to do. I want to find somebody to do the show with. And
there you go.
And I know if I do that, then I'll be doing two shows, which compared to what you do is like, you know, nothing, but
it's still a lot of work. Doing one show is a lot of work. So
it really is. I think now that I have to produce and edit a show, I think I have a greater appreciation for what you and all the other, you know, really great podcasters are doing. So, you know, when you're missing a week on one of your shows, I just go, hey, tell them some slack.
Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate that. So, okay. So, of course, we're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. All the back episodes of the show are on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to MASHcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various awards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Dolph DeVries, Britt Schramm, Mike Thomas, and Michael Porter for their support of MASHcast. I do appreciate it very much. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
I'm in.
Frank?
What do I say if I want to say I think I can win?
How about so long?